Mimi Ma. The day in 1948, when Ma Se-shin gets his third-class ticket for a crossing to San Francisco, his father starts addressing him in English. Forced practice for his own good. His father's magisterial British colonial speech runs rings around Se-shin's own electrical engineer's functional approximations. My son, listen to me. We're doomed. They sit in the upstairs office of the Shanghai complex, half company trading house, half family compound. The enterprise of Nanjing Road percolates up to the window, and doom is nowhere to be seen. But then Ma Se-shin is not political, and his eyesight is that of a man who has worked too many math problems by candlelight. His father, scholar of art, master calligrapher, patriarch with one major and two minor wives, can't help lapsing into metaphor. Metaphor embarrasses Se-shin. This family has come so far, from Persia to the Athens of China, you might say. Se-shin nods, although he would never say any such thing. We Hui Muslims have taken everything this country threw at us and packaged it for resale. This building, our mansion in Hangzhou. Think of what we have outlasted. Ma resilience. Ma Shouying gazes out into the August sky, staring at all the calamities the Ma Trading Company has survived. Colonial exploitation. The Taiping Uprising. The destruction of the family's silk plantations by typhoon. The 1911 Revolution and the 27 Massacre. His face turns toward the room's dark corner. Ghosts are everywhere, victims of violations that not even the philosopher magnate who hired a pilgrim to go to Mecca for him dares to name out loud. He spreads one palm on the paper-stacked desk. Even the Japanese couldn't break us. History gives Se-shin a rash, the random ebb and flow. He'll travel to the States in 4 days, one of a handful of Chinese students in all of 1948 to be granted visas. For weeks he has studied the maps, gone over the letters of acceptance, practiced all the inscrutable names. USS General Meigs, Greyhound Supercoach, Carnegie Institute of Technology. For a year and a half, he's attended matinees of movies with Gable Clark and Astaire Fred, practicing his new tongue. He plows on in English out of pride. If you want, I stay here. Want you to stay? You have no idea what I'm saying. His father's stare is like a poem. Why do you linger at this fork in the road, rubbing your eyes? You don't get me, do you, boy? Shouying pushes up from the chair and crosses to the window. He looks down the Nanjing Road, a place as eager as ever to profit from that bedlam, the future. You're this family's salvation. The communists will be here in 6 months. Then all of us. Son, face facts. You're not cut out for business. You should go to engineer's school forever. But your sisters and brothers, your cousins and aunts and uncles, Hui traders with lots of money. We won't last 3 weeks once the end comes. But the Americans, they promise. Ma Shouying crosses back to the desk and takes his boy's chin in his fingers. My son, my naive son with his pet crickets and homing pigeons and shortwave radio. The Gold Mountain is going to eat you alive. He releases his son's face and leads the way down the hall into the bookkeeper's cage, where he unlocks the grate and shoves aside a filing cabinet to reveal a wall safe whose existence Su Xin never suspected. Shou Ying extracts 3 wooden flats wrapped in satin rags. Even Su Xin can tell what they contain: generations of Ma family profit, from the Silk Road to the Bund, sunk into movable form. Ma Shouying rakes through handfuls of sparkling things, considering each for a moment, then chucking them back into their trays. At last he hits on what he's after: 3 rings, like small bird's eggs, 3 jade landscapes that he lifts to the light. Su Xin gasps,
"Look, the color!"
The color of greed, envy, freshness, growth, innocence. Green, 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 and green. From a pouch around his neck, Shou Ying produces a jeweler's loop. He sets the jade rings in the light and peers at them for what will be his last look. He hands the first ring to Su Xin, who stares at it as at a rock from Mars. It's a sinuous mass of jade trunk and branches several layers deep. "You live between 3 trees. One is behind you, the Lot, the tree of life for your Persian ancestors, the tree at the boundary of the 7th heaven that none may pass. Ah, but engineers have no use for the past, do they?" The words confuse Su Xin. He can't read his father's sarcasm. He tries to hand the first ring back, but his father is busy with the second. "Another tree stands in front of you, Fusang, a magical mulberry tree far to the east, where they keep the elixir of life." He palms the loop and looks up. "Well, you're off to Fusang now." He hands the jade over. It's detailed beyond belief. A bird flies above the topmost tangle of foliage. From the crooked branches hangs a row of silkworm cocoons. The carver must have used a diamond-tipped microscopic needle. Shou Ying presses his magnified eye up close to the last ring. "The third tree is all around you. Now. And like now itself, it will follow wherever you go." He gives the third ring to his son, who asks, "What kind of tree?" The father unwraps another box. Dark, lacquered wood unfolds on 2 sets of hinges to reveal a scroll. He undoes the scroll's ribbon, which hasn't been loosened for a long time. The scroll unrolls into a series of portraits, wizened men whose skin droops more than the folds in their robes. One leans on a staff in a forest opening. One peers through the narrow window in a wall. Another sits underneath a twisted pine. Su Xin's father taps the air above it.
"This kind. Who these men are? What they do?"
His father regards the script, so old Su Xin can't read it.
"Luo Han, Arhats, adepts who have passed through the 4 stages of enlightenment and now live in pure knowing joy."
Su Xin doesn't dare touch the radiant thing. His family is rich, of course, so rich that many of them do nothing anymore. But rich enough to own this? It angers him that his father has kept these treasures secret, and Su Xin isn't a man who knows how to get angry.
"Why I don't know about this?"
"You know now."
"What you want I do?"
"My word, your grammar is atrocious. I assume your instructors in electricity and magnetism were more competent than your English teachers."
"How old this? 1,000 years? More?"
One cupped palm calms the young man.
Son, listen. You can only store a family fortune so many ways. This was my way. I thought we would gather these things and protect them. When the world returned to sanity, we'd find them a home, a museum somewhere, where every visitor would connect our name with...
He nods at the Luohans playing on the threshold of Nirvana.
Do what you like with them. They're yours. Perhaps you'll discover what they want from you. The main thing is to keep them out of the hands of the communists. The communists will wipe their asses with them.
I take these to America? His father rolls up the scroll again, wrapping the frayed ribbon around the cylinder with great care.
A Muslim from the land of Confucius, going to the Christian stronghold of Pittsburgh with a handful of priceless Buddhist paintings. Who are we missing?
He places the scroll back into its box, then hands it to his son. Taking the box, Su Xin drops one of the rings. His father sighs and stoops to retrieve the treasure from the dusty floor. He takes the other two rings from Su Xin's hands.
These we can bake into mooncakes. The scroll? We'll have to think.
They put the trays of jewels into the safe and push the file cabinet back in front of it. Then they lock up the bookkeeper's cage, seal the office, and go downstairs. They pause outside in the Nanjing Road, thronged with people doing business, despite the looming end of the world.
I bring them back,
Su Xin says,
when my school is done and everything's safe here again.
His father gazes down the road and shakes his head. In Chinese, as if to himself, he says,
you can't come back to something that is gone.
With two steamer trunks and a cardboard suitcase, Ma Su Xin takes the train from Shanghai to Hong Kong. There he learns that his health certificate, acquired at the American consulate in Shanghai, isn't good enough for the ship's medical officer, who must be paid another $50 to examine Su Xin again. The General Meigs has just been decommissioned and transferred to the American President Lines for use as a Pacific passenger liner. It's a little world, 1,500 people wide. Su Xin bunks on one of the Asian decks, three stories beneath daylight. The Europeans are above, in the sun, with their deck chairs and liveried waiters serving cold drinks. Su Xin must shower with dozens of other men, under buckets, bare naked. The food is vile and hard to keep down. Waterlogged sausages, pasty potato, and salted ground cow. Su Xin doesn't care. He's going to America, to the great Carnegie Institute, to get a graduate degree in electrical engineering. Even the squalid Asian quarters are a luxury. No falling bombs, no rape or torture. He sits in his berth for hours, sucking on mango stones, feeling like the king of creation. They dock in Manila, then Guam, then Hawaii. After 21 days, they reach San Francisco, port of entry for the lucky land of Fusang. Su Xin stands in the immigration line with his two trunks and flimsy suitcase, each stenciled with his English name. He's Su Xin Ma now, his old self turned inside out, like a jaunty reversible jacket. Colorful patches cover the suitcase, stickers from the ship, a pink University of Nanking pennant, an orange one from the Carnegie Institute. He feels carefree. American, filled with affection for people of all nations except the Japanese. The customs official is a woman. She looks over his papers.
Is Ma your Christian or family name?
No Christian name. Only Muslim name. Hui.
Is that some kind of cult?
He smiles and nods many times. She narrows her eyes. For a panicked moment, he thinks he's been caught. He lied about his date of birth, putting down November 7th, 1925. In fact, he was born on the 7th day of the 11th month, the lunar calendar. The conversion is beyond him. She asks him the length, purpose, and location of stay, all detailed in his paperwork. The whole conversation, Su Xin decides, is a crude test of his ability to remember what he's written down. She points at his steamer trunks.
Could you open that, please? No, the other one.
She inspects the contents of the food box, 3 mooncakes surrounded by 1,000-year eggs. She gags as the tomb is opened.
Jesus, close it!
She picks through the clothes and engineering texts, stopping to examine the soles of a pair of shoes he has repaired himself. She lights upon the scroll box, which Su Xin and his father decided to leave hidden in the open.
What's in here?
Souvenir.
Chinese painting.
Open, please.
Su Xin blanks his mind. He thinks about his homing pigeons, about Planck's constant, anything except this suspect masterpiece that will, at very least, bring down customs duty far in excess of his stipend for the next 4 years, or, at worst, get him arrested for smuggling. The agent's face wrinkles at the sight of the Arhats.
Who are they?
Holy people.
What's wrong with them?
Happiness.
They see the true thing.
And what is that?
Su Xin knows nothing about Chinese Buddhism. He has only a rough estimate of English. Now he's supposed to explain enlightenment to this American woman official.
The true thing mean human beings so small and life so very big.
The agent snorts.
They've just worked this out?
Su Xin nods.
And this makes them happy?
She shakes her head and waves him through.
Lots of luck in Pittsburgh.
Su Xin becomes Winston Ma, a simple engineering fix. In myths, people turn into all kinds of things. Birds, animals, trees, flowers, rivers. Why not an American named Winston? And Fusang, his father's mythic land to the east, turns, over the years after Pittsburgh, into Wheaton, Illinois. Winston Ma and his new wife plant a substantial mulberry in their bare backyard. It's a single tree with 2 sexes, older than the separation of yin and yang, the tree of renewal, the tree at the universe's center, the hollow tree housing the sacred Tao. It's the silk tree on which the Ma family fortune was made, a tree to honor his father, who'll never be allowed to see it. He stands near the planting, its black ring of soil like a promise at his feet. He won't wipe his muddy hands even on his dungarees. His wife, Charlotte, scion of a fallen southern planting family that once sent missionaries to China, tells him,
"There's a Chinese saying, when is the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago.
The Chinese engineer smiles.
"Good one."
"When is the next best time?"
"Now." "Ah! Okay."
The smile turns real. Until today, he has never planted anything. But now, that next best of times is long and rewrites everything. Countless nows pass. In yet one more, 3 little girls eat cornflakes underneath their breakfast tree. It's summer. The mulberry puts forth its messy clusters of achenes. Mimi, The firstborn, 9 years old, sits among the fruit spatters with her little sisters, her clothes stained red, bemoaning their family's fate.
"It's all Mao's fault!"
A Sunday morning, midsummer, 1967, with Verdi blasting out of their parents' locked bedroom, as it has every Sunday of Mimi's childhood.
"That pig Mao! We'd be millionaires if it wasn't for him!"
Amelia, the youngest, stops stirring her cereal into a paste.
"Who's Mao?"
"World's biggest crook. He stole everything Grandpa owned."
"Somebody stole Grandpa's stuff?"
"Not Grandpa Tarleton. Grandpa Ma."
"Who's Grandpa Ma?"
"Chinese Grandpa," middle Carmen says.
"I've never seen him."
"Nobody's ever seen him, not even Mom."
"Dad never saw him?"
"He's in a work camp, where they put rich people." Carmen says, "How come he won't ever talk Chinese? It's suspicious."
One of the many mysteries their father is so generous with.
"Dad stole my poker chips when I was beating him."
Amelia pours milk from her bowl to feed the tree.
"Stop talking," Mimi orders. "Wipe your chin. Don't do that. You'll poison the roots."
"What does Dad even do?"
"Engineer, dope."
"I know that. I drive the train. Toot, toot. He wants me to laugh every time."
Mimi tolerates no stupidity.
"You know what he does."
Their father is inventing a phone no bigger than a briefcase that runs off a car battery and can travel anywhere. The whole family helps test it. They must go out to the garage and sit in the Chevy. Phone booth, he calls it, every time they make a long-distance call.
"Don't you think the labs are creepy?"
Carmen asks.
"How you have to sign in like it's a big prison?"
Mimi holds still and listens. Verdi pours out of her parents' upstairs window. They're allowed to eat under their breakfast tree, but only on Sunday. On a Sunday morning, they could walk to Chicago, and no one would even know. Carmen follows Mimi's gaze.
"What do you think they do in there all morning?"
Mimi shudders.
"Will you get off my wavelength? I hate when you do that."
"Do you think they touch each other naked?"
"Don't be gross."
Mimi sets down her bowl. She needs clarity and a place to think, and that means getting altitude. She steps up into the low V of the mulberry, heart pumping. "My silk farm," her father always says. "Only no silkworm." Carmen shouts,
"No climbing! Nobody in the tree! I'll tell! I'll squash you like a bug!"
This makes Amelia laugh. Mimi pauses in the stirrup. The fruits dangle down around her. She eats one. It's sweet, like a raisin. But she's sick of them. She's had so many already in her short life. The branches zigzag. It bothers her, so many different shapes of leaves. Hearts, mittens, crazy Boy Scout hands. Some are furry underneath, which creeps her out. Why would a tree need hair? All the leaves are notched with three main veins, like the three of them. She reaches up and snaps one off, knowing the horror that will follow. Thick, milky tree blood oozes from the wound. This, she thinks, is what the worms must somehow turn into silk. Amelia starts to cry.
"Stop! You're hurting it! I can hear it scream!"
Carmen looks up at the window that Mimi is trying to reach.
"Is he even Christian? Whenever he goes to church with us, he never says the Jesus stuff."
Their father, Mimi knows, is some other distant thing. He's a small, cute, smiling, warm, Muslim Chinese guy who loves math, American cars, elections, and camping. A long-term planner who stocks up sale items in the basement, works late
every night and falls asleep in the recliner to the 10 o'clock news. Everyone loves him, especially kids. But he never speaks Chinese, not even in Chinatown. Now and then he'll say something about life before America. After butterscotch ice cream or on a cool night around the campfire in a national park. How he kept pet crickets and pigeons in Shanghai. How he once shaved a peach and put the fuzz down the blouse of a servant to make her itch.
Don't laugh. I still feel bad. 1,000 years later.
But Mimi knew nothing much about the man until yesterday, an awful Saturday, when she came home from the playground in tears.
What happened? What you do?
She squared off in front of the man.
Are Chinese all communists who eat rats and love Mao?
At last he talked to her, a story from another world. Much was lost on Mimi, but as he spoke, her father turned into a character from a late-night black-and-white thriller full of dark corners, eerie music, and a cast of thousands. He told her of the stranded scholars, changed into Americans by the Displaced Persons Act. He described other Chinese who'd come with him, including one who went on to win the greatest prize in science. It stunned Mimi. The U.S. and the communists were fighting over her father's brain.
This man, Mao, he owe me lot of money. He pay me back. I take this family to a very fancy dinner. Best rat you ever eat.
She cried again until he assured her that he'd never even seen a rat up close until Murray Hill, New Jersey. He hushed and cooed.
Chinese eat many strange thing, but rat not so popular.
He took her into his study. There he showed her things she still couldn't grasp a day later. He unlocked the filing cabinet and removed a wooden box. Inside it were 3 green rings.
Mao, he never know about this. 3 magic ring. 3 tree. Past, present, future. Lucky, I have 3 magic daughter.
He tapped his finger on his temple.
Your father always thinking.
He took the ring he called the past and tried it on Mimi's finger. The twisting green foliage mesmerized her. The carving was deep, branches beyond branches. Impossible that anyone could carve a thing so small.
This all jade.
She jerked her hand, and the ring flipped to the floor. Her father knelt down and swept it back into the box.
Too big. We wait for later.
The box went back into the file cabinet, which he locked again. Then he crouched in his closet and removed a lacquered case. He placed the case on his drafting table and undid the ritual of latches and ribbons. 2 flicks of the scroll rollers, and there, spread in front of her, was China. The half of her no more real than a fable. Chinese words tumble down in columns, swirling like tiny flames. Each ink stroke shone as if she had just made it herself. It didn't seem possible that anyone could write like that. But her father could, if he wanted. After the flowing words came a parade of men, each a chubby skeleton. Their faces laughed, but their skin sagged. They seemed to have lived for hundreds of years. Their eyes smiled at the best joke in creation, while their shoulders bowed under the weight of a thing too heavy to bear.
Who are they?
Her father studied the figures.
These men?
His lips tightened like the smiling figures.
Luo Han. Arhat. Little Buddha. They solve life. They pass the final exam.
He turned her chin toward him,
When he smiled, the thin gold edge of his front tooth flashed. Chinese superhero! She wriggled free from his hand and studied the holy men. One sat in a small cave. One had a red sash and earrings. Another paused on the edge of a high cliff with crags and fog trailing off behind him. One leaned against a tree, as Mimi would lean against her mulberry the next day, telling her sisters. Her father pointed at the dream landscape. "This China, very old." Mimi touched the man under the tree. Her father lifted her hand and kissed her fingertips. "Too old for touch." She stared at the man, whose eyes knew everything.
"Superheroes?"
"They see every answer. Nothing hurt them anymore. Emperor, come and go. Qing, Ming, Yuan. Communism, too. Little insect on a giant dog. But these guy?"
He clicked his tongue and held up his thumb as if these little Buddhas were the ones to put money on in the run of time. At that click, a teenage Mimi lifted from her own 9-year-old shoulders to gaze at the Arhats from high up and years away. Out of the gazing teen rose another, even older woman. Time was not a line unrolling in front of her. It was a column of concentric circles with herself at the core and the present floating outward along the outermost rim. Future selves stacked up above and behind her, all returning to this room for another look at the handful of men who had solved life.
"Look the color," Winston said, and all her later selves collapsed around Mimi. "China, surely a funny place."
He rolled up the scroll and put it in its case back on the closet floor. In the mulberry, Mimi thinks that if she could ascend another few feet above the earth, she might look into her parents' window and see what Verdi is doing to them. But down on earth, revolution erupts.
"No climbing!" Amelia yells. "Get down!"
"Shut your trap," Mimi suggests.
"Dad! Mimi's in the silk farm!"
Mimi drops to the ground, a foot from crushing her little sister. She grabs the kid's mouth and gags her.
"Shut up, and I'll show you something!"
With the perfect hearing of childhood, both sisters know the something is worth seeing. In another moment, under cover of the swelling Verdi chorus, they creep together, commando style, into their father's office. The filing cabinet is locked, but Mimi opens the lacquered box. The scroll unrolls on Winston's drafting table to the image of a figure seated underneath a gnarled, patient tree.
"Don't touch! They're our ancestors, and they're gods!"